This is Stella Peroni with Ed Addio, September 30th at his home in Alta Vista in Mill Valley.
123 Alta Vista.
Okay. Ed, why don't you start off with a little bit about your family history?
Okay. We know quite a bit about my side. My paternal great-grandfather, Giovanni Addio, and great-grandmother Christina Perillo were from a little town called Tuoro, T-U-O-R-O, at the foot of Monte Cassino, on the Mediterranean coast, halfway between Rome and Naples. And the rumor is that Christina, the great-grandmother, became the first mayor of that village and ultimately financed the family coming to America. Apparently, the mayor made a lot of money, either legally or illegally. We never really know. Their children were my grandmother, Teresa. Now, wait a second. My grandfather, Gennaro, G-E-N-A-R-O, Addio, was brought here in 1910. No, brought here in 1882, something like that, when he was 10 years old. And he married Angela Perilla, his first wife. She was very wealthy, but they lost all their money in the Depression of 1929, the crash. He then married a Caterina, and she was my father's stepmother. Grandpa made money walking. The Brooklyn Bridge was built only for pedestrians only originally, no cars. So he would walk across the Brooklyn Bridge to Wall Street, Manhattan, and shine shoes all day. That's how he made some money. And he eventually became a barber in Brooklyn, who was very, very well known. Big funeral. My grandfather gave birth to my father in 1907. My father, Edmund G. Addio, Sr. I'm actually Edmund G. Addio, Jr. My father had three brothers. Alfred, Eugene, two brothers. There were three boys, Alfred and Eugene. And he married my mother, Julia Crean Addio, in 1932. My father actually had a sister, my Aunt Eleanor, who was really good looking. She was Miss Coney Island in 1932. I always used to rib her about it. My mother's family came from Galway, in a little village called Listaverni. I don't know whether that's a Gaelic word or a Hungarian word or what. It's not even really a village. It's like a townsland area, a whole series of outback houses. We went over and visited them and couldn't actually find it exactly where it was. But her mother was Catherine Logan. And her father was the Colonel Logan, after whom the Logan Airport in Boston was named for. He was a Civil War colonel. And let's see, she married Matthew Crean, who died in the flu epidemic of 1918, she had 13 children. Five of them died early on, but when he died, he left her with eight children, five girls and three boys, and totally penniless. We did a family history a couple of years ago and found all kinds of pictures of my side of the family, but we couldn't find any pictures of my grandmother or my grandfather or any of those early pictures, and we all couldn't figure out why. And I called my sister. It finally dawned on us they were too poor to have a camera. You know, we were all brought up with cameras. My father was a fireman in Coney Island, had a good job. At one time, he was supporting three families during the Depression. So my mother's mother, my grandmother, raised these kids on practically nothing. So there were no pictures of her around whatsoever. I have an old, old picture of her sitting on the beach in Coney Island when she was about 80 years old. So that was that. So then, let's see, where are we? So my father and my mother, Julia Crean, had me, Edmund Jr., in 1936, and my November 6, 1936, and my sister Brenda on September 13th, 1939. So, let's see, so I was raised in Flatbush, the Flatbush section of Brooklyn. My father retired from the fire department in 1954 and brought us out to Los Angeles. In fact, it's a funny story. We only knew one person on the West Coast, and his name was Bill Shelley, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y. Bill was my Uncle John's partner in a New York City police department. Uncle John, when he got out of the Seabees in the Navy after World War II, was a detective in the New York City police department and ultimately became Fiorello LaGuardia's bodyguard. So Bill Shelley was his partner. Bill retired and moved to L.A. So when my father retired, he had Bill Shelley's name and address. So we drove across country on July 4th, 1954, hit Los Angeles on the freeway. It was Route 66, you know, Kingman, Barstow, San Bernardino. So we're coming along, and the speed limit was 55 miles an hour. So we're doing 55 miles an hour, which was the fastest we'd ever driven in a car. So pretty soon, my father gets a little lost, pulls off the freeway in downtown Los Angeles. And my mother's screaming in the back seat, and my sister and I are panic-stricken. So he's driving down Spring Street, downtown L.A. And in those days, they had a cop on every street corner directing traffic. They were white-gloved rookie cops. So we come to 2nd Street, 3rd Street, and my mother's yelling, "Pull over, pull over, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph." Come to 4th Street, 5th Street, my father's yelling, "Quiet, Jewel," blah, 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 they're yelling, my sister's crying. So finally at about 6th Street, my father stops in the middle of the intersection, rolls down his window and starts asking the cop directions. Cop says, "What are you doing? Pull over there to the corner." My father pulls over to the corner. The cop sees the New York license plates now, so knows we're lost. So the cop comes over to my father and says, "You don't stop in the middle of the intersection. What do you want?" My father says, "We're lost. We're looking for a town in the San Fernando Valley." So the cop says, "Okay, you turn around, go back, and you'll see the Hollywood Freeway, and you get on that." And the cop says, "Whereabouts in the San Fernando Valley?" And my father says, "A little town called Reseda." And the cop says, "Whereabouts in Reseda?" Gives my father this funny look. And my father pulls out the address, and he said, "Hesperia Avenue." And the cop says, "Where on Hesperia Avenue?" My father says, 4298, whatever the number was. And the cop says, "Who are you visiting?" My father says, "A guy named Bill Shelley." And the cop says, "I live with him." Do you believe that? Incredible story.
Wait, was it his son?
No, he was renting a room. It was a rookie cop, lived in the valley, and was renting a room from Bill Shelley. The most amazing story
wow.
I've ever heard.
Amazing. And you were about 20 at this time, is that right?
I had just graduated 54? From high school. I had just turned 18.
Because
my birthday's in November. I graduated on January 30th from high school. We had to wait till June to take off because of my sister's school. She was a freshman in high school. And I had a scholarship to Notre Dame, but I gave it up thinking I'd go to Loyola. And so we came out, and between January 30th and taking the exam to get into Loyola in August, I had forgotten 1 point's worth of information, and I flunked the Loyola test by 1 point. So I ended up at UCLA. So anyway, so that gets us to
Okay.
Los Angeles. So I ended up going to, I went to a couple of junior colleges down there, UCLA. I would have been a doctor, but I couldn't get anything higher than a C in chemistry. So I was an engineering student, I actually became an engineer. And I worked for Rocketdyne, division of North American Aviation, at their field test facility in the Santa Susana Mountains in west of the valley, between the valley and Simi Valley. And I worked on the Atlas missile, on the booster engine and the sustainer engines for the Atlas missile and the Titan missile eventually. And my claim to fame, with my contribution to the American, I saved the American space effort, which is what I say, because the booster engine was crashing into the sustainer engine and the whole thing was blowing up on the test stand, a big ball of fire. So on the engine, there was a little, I think we called a gimbal mount, G-I-M-B-A-L. And that was the little ball bearing type on which the sustainer engine swerved. So instead of crashing into the sustainer engine and blowing up the missile, I redesigned it so it wouldn't, a couple of degrees less of a swerve, so it didn't no longer crash into the...
Were you a mechanical engineer?
Yeah, mechanical. So anyway, that's how I saved the American space effort. But eventually I got tired of doing trig problems for the government. And I quit engineering altogether and went to work for a newspaper in Los Angeles, because I really thought I was F. Scott Fitzgerald under the skin, because I'd always wanted to be a writer, not an engineer. And so I worked on that newspaper for a couple of years until we moved to Los Angeles.
Wait, until you moved to?
Until I moved to San Francisco.
Got it.
So let's see, how did I meet Jovita? Oh, Jovita's family.
Wait, how old are you now?
When I met Jovita and got married, I met her when I was 21. We got married when I was 23, and she was 21. Actually, I was 23 going on 15, and she was 21 going on 40, if you catch my drift. Her mother was Thelma Talia Pietra. T-A-L-I-A-P-I-E-T-R-A. And they were from a little town in northern Italy, just east of Lago di Garda, called Calvene. And her parents, my mother-in-law's parents, were also a Caterina. Talia Pietra from Calvene, but she and her husband lived on opposite sides of this valley. So they never knew each other until they came to America, and they met as teenagers in Chicago. So she married Tavita's grandfather when she was 16 and he was 18. And they moved to a farm in... it was in Wisconsin, in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. So Jovita was born in Fond du Lac and raised there. Her father was an orphan. Her father's name was George Reichling, R-E-I-C-H-L-I-N-G. And his sister Adele, both orphaned. Adele became a nun, and she took the name Sister Jovita. Turns out there were two monks in medieval Italy named Faustus and Jovita. And Jovita was named after this nun, and she always thanks God that the nun didn't become Sister Faustus. That could be her name today. So anyway, I met Jovita at, she enrolled in Queen of Angels School of Nursing in downtown Los Angeles, and my sister was in the same class at Queen of Angels. So my sister was having a slumber party in our house in Canoga Park, out in the end of the valley. And a bunch of friends of mine and myself raided the pajama party. And my parents had a pool, and Jovita hates it, but the way I put it was I ended up with Jovita in our pajamas. But the next day, all the nurses around the pool, we came back, went swimming, we were flirting around with everybody. And I took a shine to Jovita, and she gave me her address. Turns out she lived 50 miles away, clear across over into the San Gabriel Valley, a place called Monrovia. So when I courted Jovita, I had to drive 50 miles to see her. We'd go get a pizza, go to a drive-in. I'd stay over at her house and drive her back to the hospital on Sunday evening. And then I'd keep going up to Canoga Park to my house. So we were married on April 23rd, 1960. This year was our 55th anniversary. And I always say the last 54 years have been very happy, because I was a real jerk when we first got married. So let's see, it brings us to San Francisco. Actually, when our first baby was born in Los Angeles, we decided LA was no place to raise a family. Boy, were we lucky. So we flipped the coin, San Diego or San Francisco. And it came up San Francisco. We moved up here, lived in the Sunset District for 2 years. We always wondered why they call it that, because we never did see a sunset. And after 2 years, we came out here to visit a friend of mine. I got a job working for McGraw-Hill. McGraw-Hill had a system of news bureaus, sort of like UPI and Associated Press has all around the world. So I worked for the San Francisco News Bureau as a writer. They liked my technical background and my journalism background, because they had 47 trade publications. So I was a correspondent for Chemical Week, Business Week, Aviation Week, all kinds of technical trade magazines. So anyway, I was visiting a friend of mine from McGraw-Hill out here, who was renting an apartment in Enchanted Knolls.
What was his name?
The name is Walt Forsiak, F-O-R-S-I-A-K. And they were renting a little apartment on Kipling. On Shelley Drive. And so we were walking around saying, gee, it would be nice to live out here. And just by chance, the manager of the apartment complex was outside. And I was telling him, we live in the Sunset, and we'd really like to move out here. You know of any places to rent? And the guy said, well, if you can wait 2 months, I just resigned my job at KPIX in the city and gave them my notice, I'm moving, and I'm giving up this apartment. You could have this one. So I said, great. So we ended up there. It was apartment 9 at 10 Shelley Drive in Chandon Knolls. We lived there until 1970.
How many years was that?
Was that 6 years, I guess. From 7 years. 63 to 70. Little two-room apartment. Girls just had shared one little room. Two-bedroom apartment. And a little kitchen, living room area. And that was about it. Actually, three rooms. Two bedrooms and a big kitchen, living room. And so we lived there until 1970.
How old were the girls then? The girls were born.
My daughter Denise was born in 1961. And my daughter Nicole was born when we moved up here. She was born in 1963. She was born in the Sunset area right before we moved to Mill Valley. I forget the name of the parish we were in. It was right near, 47th and Taravelle. It was a block from the beach.
Is that Holy Cross?
No, St. Gabriel's, something like that. Oh! Okay, so, Yeah, Denise was born in 63. Nicole was born in... Denise was 61, Nicole was 63. when I hired on at McGraw-Hill, when we came to San Francisco in the sunset, my salary was $400 a month, which we thought was big money. And
so that was a good salary in those days.
In those days it was. So we moved out to the apartment in Shelley Drive, and the houses, we couldn't quite afford a house, so we rented there for 7 years.
Do you remember what you paid rent?
$130 a month. So Jovita was here at this house at a garage sale and didn't see anything she wanted. I was home pecking away on my typewriter trying to write a book. I had resigned from McGraw-Hill to write an epic historical novel about Yosemite Valley, which I'll go into later. And so I was home pecking away at the typewriter and minding the kids. Jovita was at the garage sale. I finally said to the lady, I don't see anything I like, you know, anything else around that I haven't seen. And the lady said, well, how about the house? We're thinking of selling it. And Jovita said, you'll show me around. So Jovita, the gal showed Jovita around. Jovita said, don't tell that to anybody until I go get my husband. So Jovita comes running home and says, I found us a house. And I said, what?
Were you actively looking for a house?
No. I said to Jovita, are you nuts? We have $1.98 in the bank. No, we were living check to check. We had no money. And I said, you know, how much does the house cost? She said, well, it's $32,000. But they'll give us a lease option for a year, renewable for a year. And I said, well, how the hell can we do this? And she said, well, let's figure this out. So what we ended up doing is we borrowed $1,000 from her father. And we put $1,000 down on the house to lease it for a year. Well, I had sold my first book, and with that advance, we paid off her father. At the end of that first year, we still had a couple of thousand left, and no, we didn't have any money left to renew it. We borrowed another $1,000 from my father. So we renewed the lease for another year. Okay, by this time, it's 1972. The real estate market had hit the fan, and we only needed $2,400 to buy the house, a $32,000 house. And by that time, I had sold another book, my second book, and we had the $2,400 and bought the house, 1970. And we've been here ever since.
You bought it with, and then you got a conventional mortgage along with the $2,400.
Right. And yeah, at that time, it was a 90% mortgage, too, which you couldn't get any more these days. So that's how we finally...
What was the purchase price on it, if you don't mind?
$32,000.
Oh, I'm sorry. You told
yeah.
me. Yeah. Yeah.
So, again, sheer luck. We've been very lucky. By sheer luck, we got into this house. And I didn't even have a job at the time. Finally, I had sold a few more books and got in and out of the advertising public relations business. Eventually, I ended up selling, I think I've had 12 books published by now. And off and on, you know, roller coaster type career, you know, feast and famine. And then finally, I opened up my own marketing communications agency in 1990. Ran that for 8 years with Jerry Byers. Jerry Byers was my associate at the agency. And then retired, and I've been just freelancing on my own ever since. Jovita got a job years ago with Sunny Hills Children's Services up in San Anselmo. She became the medical director. So she had about 5 nurses and 2 physicians working for her, and she finally retired from that after 25 years. She retired about 5 years ago, and about a year after that, they called her from St. Vincent's School for Boys, and they wanted her to come to work there. She said, no, I'm retired. I don't want to work, you know, sorry. And they said, well, how about just 2 days a week? And she said, okay, I could do 2 days a week just to keep my finger in the pie. So she's been doing that. She still does that 2 days a week. And she just turned 75 years old. So here we are now. We're real estate wealthy and cash poor. Because the house is crazy. It just got appraised for $1.7 million. And, you know, just by sheer luck, here we are. So let's see. That was about that. What else do you want to know? Oh, my writing career, maybe.
Ed, what was Mill Valley like when you first moved here in 64? 63, sorry.
Well, it was a lot different, like a lot of people are saying from the oral histories that I've been reading. Well, let's see. The Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church had not been built. We went to church in the school auditorium with the collapsible chairs. The kids went to Our Lady of Mount Carmel School. Jovita was the school nurse for years, following Marilyn Monardo. And so we watched the church being built, officially opened in 1967. Mill Valley, when we moved here on the corner of Blythedale and Camino Alto, where that little shopping center is now, where the cantina is, that used to be a big old Quonset hut-shaped Purity Market. It belonged to the either the Mormons or the Seventh-day Adventists, I forget which. But it was closed. It was totally empty. That we never got to shop there. Also on the corner where the Spinning Chicken is now. What's the name of that Italian place on the corner?
I knew it until you asked me.
Pollo Rolo, Pollo Loco.
Pollo
Rolo. We call it the Spinning Chicken. In Italian, it means spinning chicken. Anyway, that place was, there was a little house there where a veterinarian ran a little veterinary clinic out of his house. After that, it became a fast food place. And then eventually it became...
That's right, it was Wiener Schnitzel.
The Wiener Schnitzel, that's right. That's right. And there was a little horse stable where the old community center used to be. There was a horse corral where the current community center is now. And of course, the traffic was a fraction of what it is today. Everybody's complaining. I remember when Jean Barnard was running for city council. We were still in the apartment. She knocked on the door. And I invited her in. We were talking. And she said, the greatest threat to the future of Mill Valley is the automobile. And at the time, I thought that was kind of peculiar because we didn't have any traffic problems. But she was right. That's the biggest threat to Mill Valley right now. So that's changed. Downtown, they had Varney's Hardware Store. Sal Aversa, a friend of mine, the same guy I was visiting when we rented the apartment in Chile in Shandon Knolls, Walt Forsiak and I were walking down the street downtown, and we saw this sign, a brand new restaurant had just opened, and it was La Ginestra. So we walked in, and it used to be like a diner set up. There were stools and a long counter, just like a diner. We walked in, there was a guy at the diner eating something or other. And we sat down and ordered a pizza from Sal. And we said, wow, this is great. How long have you been open? And Sal looked at his watch and he said, about half an hour. We were the second customers in La Ginestra. Sal was great. So that was sort of our favorite restaurant at the time. Every Friday night we'd go to La Ginestra. And we'd see everybody we knew in town because I was pretty active in town politics. I was coaching Little League. I was on a Lady of Mount Carmel Church parish council. I was the president or chairman, I forget the term, of the PTA for a while. I shared that with Joan Bosnicker. And so we'd go into La Ginestra on Friday night, everybody in the place would know us. We'd jump from table to table visiting people. It was a lot of fun. And then every year on my birthday, the kids would take me there. We'd have a pizza. They'd have Shirley Temples. Jovita and I would have a couple of glasses of wine. And the bill was, I think, around $11. So that was fun. I coached Little League. When we were in the apartments, someone called me. I was always been interested in baseball. Played a lot of baseball when I was young. I actually played ball with Joe Torre in Brooklyn, New York, when we were kids in Marine Park.
He's a pro player, obviously.
Joe Torre grew up to be a Hall of Fame baseball player and manager of the Yankees. And I think he's going to become commissioner of baseball pretty soon. Anyway, somebody called me and said, somebody's coaching a team, a Little League team. You ever think about coaching? And I said, well, no, not really, but I'd like to get interested. And he said, well, this guy is coaching. I forget his name. He doesn't know the first thing about baseball. You know, we need somebody who knows who his assistant is. So I said, okay. I went down to Boyle Park, introduced myself to him, and we started coaching a team. And he finally quit. He didn't know anything about baseball, and I sort of took over the team. And I coached Little League for almost 20 years and never finished lower than second place. Came in first 10 times. I was a good coach.
What level?
This was minor league for a while, and then for 3 years we formed a senior league, and then for 3 years I coached in a senior league. And then I ran for city council in 1976, I think. And at the time I was running against Joan Bosnaker. And Mill Valley, a woman has never lost running for city council in Mill Valley, ever, unless she was running against another woman. And I lost that election by 100 votes, closer than anybody had come. And the fact it was so close, they invited me to a budget meetings that year, and they were looking for a city manager, and I recommended Doug Dawson, who was the city manager at Corte Madera, who I'd known. And lo and behold, they hired Doug Dawson. So I like to think I had an influence on that because he became a very good city manager. Anyway, 2 years later, Jim Arbios, A-R-B-I-O-S, was leaving the Planning Commission. And he's my neighbor here across the street. So he called and said, how'd you like to be on the Planning Commission and take my place? So I said, sure. So I put my name in. They picked me. I was on the Planning Commission for 6 years. Ended up being the chairman of the commission. And again, coincidentally, I was the chairman when a little girl named Jenny Fully.
Wait, hold on. Was it the Planning Commission or the Parks and Rec Commission?
Parks and Rec Commission. Okay. Sorry. We can correct that in the transcript. Parks and Rec Commission. I was the chairman. And a little girl named Jenny Fully, F-U-L-L-E, wanted to play Little League, and the city fathers said, no, girls are not allowed. And she got all upset. I got all upset. We took a vote in the Planning Commission, and 4-3, we voted to let her play. Sent it up to the city council. They turned it down. They said, no, she can't play. Jenny sued the city.
Hold on, was that a Little League rule that she couldn't play, or a city
Little League from Williamsport,
okay, Pennsylvania? Okay, but wait. So, but if the Parks and Rec Department and the City Council all voted that she could play, you weren't really the governing body, right?
No, but the Little League said if we let her play, they would take away our franchise. Oh. So it wouldn't actually be Little League; it would be the Mill Valley
Baseball club,
like San Anselmo does.
Right.
She sued Little League in Williamsport. It was a big trial up in Superior Court. And Little League sent out psychiatrists from big Beverly Hills psychiatrists, all kinds of doctors and orthopedists testified how terrible it would be if a girl played Little League. and the bad language the boys used she shouldn't be able to hear, and how girls weren't structured, their skeletal features for having babies, not for athletics. It was just terrible. Anyway, the judge, I got involved a little bit on the sidelines with that, but the judge finally said, Little League will let Jenny Foley play, or I will shut down Little League all over the country. And Williams, she sent a letter to President Nixon. She got a letter back, and finally Little League had Congress change the franchise bylaws from saying shall be a league for boys only into shall be a league for boys and girls. Actually, by congressional writ, that was changed. So she was quite instrumental in girls being able to play athletics.
Did she miss that whole, I imagine this took quite a while. Did she miss that?
It took about a year. She missed that season. Next season she was allowed to play, but she was 12. So she played just for a year and then gave it up.
How'd she do?
She did great. She hit home runs. She was a fabulous, she was a big kid. But she was powerful, good ball player. If she hadn't been a girl, probably she would have gone on to greater heights in the female athletics in high school and college.
And the boys all accepted her fine?
They accepted her fine. There was no psychological problems. They watched their language. You know, they were little gentlemen. What she says. And then she went on. She finally got a job. Oh, by the way, when she was trying to play and suing the town and Little League, the rednecks came out of the woodwork. She was getting windows in her house broken.
Where'd she live?
She lived in Sutton Manor somewhere. Her mother was a single working mom. She worked in a doctor's office. But she would get taunted in high school, in school. Her mother would get obscene phone calls in the middle of the night from Little League parents. It was just terrible. Terrible. Well, she finally got a job with Lucas, up at Lucas Ranch, and she became quite famous, and she's now the vice president of special effects at Sony Films. Yeah, really good job.
Why did she sue the city? Because it sounds like the city wanted her to play.
The city didn't want her to play because they would lose their franchise.
Oh, okay. So the city council voted against it.
Right.
Oh, okay. So the plant parts and rec voted for it.
City Williamsport threatened the city. They let her play. And then they finally had her back down. So anyway, that was my Parks and Rec Commission career.
What other issues did you have on the Parks and Rec Commission?
I was very upset. We had the Parks and Rec director at the time was Don Hunter. And right after I joined, he gave us a tour of all the facilities around town. And one of the facilities was the old golf clubhouse. It was right across from where the golf clubhouse is now, across the road.
It's the same one, right? Isn't it?
No, it was an old one. It was a smaller little theater. It wasn't a big auditorium type place it is today.
Oh.
Where the all the clubs meet and people have wedding receptions and things now. It was much smaller.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're talking about the rec department, not the golf clubhouse across from the golf course.
No, the golf clubhouse. Across from the current clubhouse, across the road, there was a little theater.
Okay.
And with backstage at that theater, the electrical system was so horrible that I kind of went to Don Hunter. I said, Don, this place, there's going to be a fire here. This place is, don't let the fire department see this. Well, lo and behold, a couple of months later, the place burned down. And that's when they moved the Mill Valley Theater Company over to where it is on Miller right now. And then they built the current facility at the, they call it the golf clubhouse, but it's actually where all the service clubs meet and people have wedding receptions now. So it's quite a nice little facility. And then, of course, they built the community center where it is now, and that's where a lot of other meetings are held. So I was involved with that. That was fun. No real big issues that I recall. But it was fun being on the commission. PTA, Little League, things like that.
Any big issues you remember with PTA?
No.
Were you involved in the closing of Mount Carmel School?
I wasn't involved, but I was against it. We had a really controversial pastor, Father Ring, Father John Ring, who never liked the school. And every year he would, in spring, he would drop the hint that the school might not open. Well, naturally, a lot of mothers would, just in case, enroll their kids over at St. Hilary's or St. Patrick's. Well, of course, the attendance was slowly diminishing. And it was kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy on his part, because eventually the enrollment got down so low, he announced, the enrollment is too low, we have to close the school, which is what he wanted all along. A bunch of women tried to open it up again. They raised the money to pay the salaries and everything else. But the archdiocese finally said, no, close it down. So that was a shame, because it was a nice little school. School had at the time for the church, if you remember, you were a teenager, we had a teen club, and Jovita and I were sponsors of it for a long time. And I still know a bunch of those kids that are now grown-ups. Chris Murphy, the Peroni girls, Greg Minardo, and what's his brother's name?
Jeff.
Jeff Minardo. And all those kids are now, they all have gray hair, some of them. Anyway, so that was, we're still there. We're still parishioners. We've been parishioners now for, I guess, 50 years. A little over 50, I guess.
Now, you put together the parish history. Is that true?
Yeah, I wrote a history of the parish for a while. Was founded in 1882, something like that. And came to about 16 pages. It's a nice little pamphlet that's available at the rectory for anybody who wants to see it. Did you ever get a look at it?
No, I mean to.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Anyway, so let's see. What else can I talk about? Oh.
Hey, Ed, tell me a little bit about what you did at your marketing communication agency and the years again.
Okay, I opened it up in... I'd always wanted to run my own operation. I opened it up in 1990 as Addio & Associates Marketing Communications. And almost all of our clients were high-tech clients down in Silicon Valley. And the reason I knew that, I could sort of speak semiconductor, because when I was working with McGraw-Hill in from 62 to 68, Fairchild Semiconductor became the first semiconductor company in Silicon Valley. A guy named Bob Noyce had invented the semiconductor when he worked at Texas Instruments. And then, so when he invented the semiconductor, he opened up Fairchild Semiconductor in Mountain View, and then a whole bunch of other semiconductor companies followed as, left Fairchild to start their own companies. At the time, it wasn't called Silicon Valley, and at the time, I was left the news bureau at McGraw-Hill and became the West Coast editor of Electronics Magazine, which was the McGraw-Hill's electronics book.
Roughly the year of that?
Yeah, this was in 1966. And so as the West Coast editor of Electronics Magazine, which was the Bible of the industry at the time, there was only one other electronics publication called Electronics News. And the West Coast guy at Electronic News was a fellow named Walt Matthews. And Walt and I became very good friends. We were friendly competitors because his Electronic News was a weekly, and my magazine was a monthly. So once in a while, I'd come up with a scoop of a story, but I couldn't really use it, you know, sit on it for 3 weeks for my magazine. So I'd give him the story. So he'd run the scoop in Electronic News. Then he'd back off and let me do a bit more developed story for my monthly magazine. So we became very good friends. And one guy down there, they used to hang out at a bar, all the Fairchild people, and lately some of the other semiconductor people would hang out at a bar called the Wagon Wheel in Mountain View. And we were sitting there one night, drinking with all the engineers and people, and everybody would call it Semiconductor Gulch. And finally, Walt Matthews and I said, let's call it Silicon Valley. No, somebody said, well, let's call it Silicon Gulch. And everybody thought, yeah, that's a nice name. But then Walt Matthews and I started calling it Silicon Valley in our publications. And that's how Silicon Valley got its name. So I take credit for that too. So eventually I had a lot of semiconductor clients when I ran my agency. I had Jiffy Lube was a commercial account. I had a lot of fun with that account. And then meanwhile, back to living in Mill Valley, I was playing the guitar at the time, learning to play the guitar. So we'd sit up till 2 a.m. in our little apartment playing the guitar with a bunch of guys. We'd run out of wine, and we'd run over to a little liquor store, kind of where Slope Nursery is now. It was called Dell's, I think. And he'd be open till 2 a.m, so we'd get a jug of wine from him, come back to the apartment, and keep playing. A lot of times after he closed up, we'd go down to a little bar where Mill Valley Market, the new section is now right next to the flower stand. Used to be a little bar called Quinn's. And it was run by this little, tiny little old Irish guy named James Quinn, who drank about a quart of whiskey a day by his own admission. He was always drunk. So we went in there one night with a friend of mine trying to get a late night jug of wine. All the cops and firemen hung out there too. That's where they did their drinking. So it was kind of okay to sell us, you know, after hours booze. So we went in there one night, it was about 1 a.m. And we asked him for a jug of wine. He said, okay. So he bends down behind the bar and we're talking and sipping our drink. 5 minutes, he doesn't come up. So we finally look over the bar, and here's Quinn just kneeling there on one knee. His hand comes up over the bar, his fingers, he pulls himself up, his hand is smashed out of his mind. He said, I'm sorry, this service is so slow. I had to fire my regular bartender for drinking on the job. Funny guy. He was a scream. All the chiefs of police that I've ever known used to hang out at Quinn's too until he finally closed up. There was a rumor that at one time he owned all the liquor licenses in southern Marin County. He was quite a character. So Varney's is gone. The old mill, we used to hang out at a place called the Old Mill where that restaurant is now.
Basco's, yeah.
Basco's. In fact, I wrote a book there in longhand sitting at the bar. We rented a little room. Well, should I give you my book history now?
Yeah, I want to know what book you wrote, The Old Mill Tavern.
Yeah, okay, well, my first book I wrote while I was still working for McGraw-Hill, and that was a book about minor league baseball called Low and Outside. Turns out when Jovita was in high school down in Monrovia, she was dating a guy named Jerry Kettle, just like in Tea Kettle. And he was with the Phillies organization, and he worked himself up 3 times to AAA ball, but never quite made it to the majors. So after we got married and moved up here, we stayed friends with Jerry, and he was up here with some friends one day and started telling me some hilarious stories about when he was in the minor leagues. So I sat him down with a tape recorder one weekend, and he dictated his story, and I turned it into a book.
Mostly about Jerry and his experiences?
Yeah, it was actually Low and Outside, the autobiography of a minor leaguer. by Jerry Kettle with Ed Addio. That was published by I'll think of it. They're all mainstream publishers. Anyway, so that was my first book. That was nonfiction. Then I wrote a science fiction novel called The Fortech Conspiracy. It was about UFOs. That came out in 1967. And the following year, I wrote another science fiction, I guess it was science fiction.
And you weren't work. This was your.
This is freelancing. This is okay, after I quit McGraw-Hill.
Okay, so you were. That was risky.
Yeah, I was unemployed. That's why we only had $1 in the bank when we bought the house. I was still trying to make a living as a writer. And so.
That's patient of Jovita.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't you think?
Yeah. Yeah. She hung in there. Anyway, so then my third book was a book about mental telepathy. It was a sort of an adventure spy novel, and that was called The Talbot Agreement. That was in 68. And then I rented an office above a pet shop in downtown Mill Valley. In fact, the guys who run the pet shop next to the paint store on Miller now, when they were young teenagers, the Chinese guys, they were young teenagers. They worked at the pet store. And it was the Brabo building. Tony Brabo was my landlord. I rented a room up there. Well, anyway, in the afternoons, I'd go over to the, I co-wrote it with a guy named Dick Garvin. We'd go over to the old mill and sit at the bar, drink Rainier Ale, and write the book in longhand. And that book finally came out. It was a book about an old black folk singer named Leadbelly, Hootie Leadbetter. And that came back out in 1970.
Well, did you write most of your books in longhand then? Because you didn't have word processors. It would be a typewriter.
I had an old Underwood number 10 typewriter, a Hunt and Peck. I still type with two fingers. The typewriter I used, which I still have, who was that famous CBS, Walter Cronkite? It was his typewriter when he worked at the Daily News. And I bought it, a guy brought it out from New York to McGraw-Hill, and I bought it from him for $5 when I left McGraw-Hill. Still have it. Anyway, so I wrote that, most of my books on that typewriter until we got a computer. So that was Leadbelly. That got a front page New York Times book review, a rave review, very good review. I was on a Tonight Show, I was on a Today Show, did a 25-city radio, TV, promotional tour.
What was it like being on The Tonight Show?
Oh, it was great. It was great. I was on, it used to be the last 10 minutes or so, about 12:15, whatever. They had actors and writers on to plug their books and movies and things. Not like it is today where every celebrity in the world is on. And then on the Today Show, I was interviewed by a guy named Jack Laskewy, yeah. That was fun. Anyway, the book started to take off. Famous New York Times, got great reviews, and the publisher was Bernard Geis, who was flying high in New York because he had published Valley of the Dolls, which became a big hit. And then Bernard Geis, while my book was getting great reviews, filed a Chapter 11 and went bankrupt. No one could restock the book because none of the bookstores would carry it anymore. So it was sort of stillborn. I recently republished it myself just to give it new life. It's called The Midnight Special. And then I wrote a book, I wrote a nonfiction book.
It's really bad luck.
That's really bad luck, yeah. After all the good luck stories I've been telling, that was a bad luck story. But then I wrote a book, I wrote a pro-marriage divorce book called Inside Divorce. The subtitle was, Is It Really What You Want? And I composed a 150 questionnaire interviewed 1,000 divorced people all around the country. Cosmopolitan magazine at the time called it the largest survey of divorced people ever. And in that survey, and in the book, I report that 88% of all the people I surveyed, one of the questions was, if you had it to do all over again, what would you do differently? And 88% of the people said, I'd try harder to stay married, which was really a surprise. So that book came out in about 73. That was pretty successful too. Then I did a book called Ego Speak. That was subtitle of that one is Why No One Listens to You. And that was about a book about, I once wrote a college paper. It occurred to me that people are always thinking about what they want to say next instead of actually listening to what the other person is saying. So if you tell me that your kid walked at 11 months, I'm trying to think, well, no, my kid walked at 10 months. So my answer is going to be about my kid, not about your kid. It was very, very well received, went sold to paperback, became a required reading at several psychology curricula around the country, University of Minnesota, University of Michigan.
It's pretty impressive that an engineer wrote a book like that.
Yeah, yeah. And then Jovita and I collaborated on a book about teenage drinking. And that was very successful, but unfortunately, again, bad luck. The sales manager of it was published by Coward McCann. The sales manager of Coward McCann was an alcoholic, and he didn't like the book whatsoever. It was called Why Our Children Drink. It's a very good book. We found out that the incidence of teenage alcoholism, again, we survey hundreds and hundreds of people all around the country. We found out that the statistics of teenage alcoholism is exactly the same as it is for adults. 1 in 10 teenagers is a clinical alcoholic. In fact, I did a great little talk at Tam High. I forget who the principal was at the time, but we'd go into these classrooms to give these lectures. And we'd close the door and tell the kids that everything we say here is personal, won't leave this classroom. And so the kids, you know, either believed us or not. But one of the questions we asked in this classroom, and by coincidence, we let the principal sit in on this one. And we asked how many kids in this class think they're an alcoholic, think they drink too much. Nobody raised their hand. So then we said, well, wait a second, let me put it this way. How many kids in this class know somebody else in this class who drinks too much? And every single hand went up. And we looked at the principal, and the principal just shook his head, said, no, nobody in this class drinks too much. Nobody in my school. But these kids, you know, once in a while, a little kid in the back row very timidly would raise his hand. And afterwards we'd talk to him and he'd say, yeah, I'm drunk at least once a week, you know, blah, blah. Really sad, sad. So anyway, that was a book called Why Our Children Drink. Let's see, what else did I write? I did a book on nutrition. I got involved with the reason I'm somewhat of a cancer expert now is I got involved with the medical Orthomolecular Medical Society in San Francisco, and I was writing a book with it was at the time I was doing a lot of interviews with there's a guy that won 2 Nobel Prizes, one for biochemistry and one for peace.
Not Pauling, is it?
Yeah, Linus Pauling.
Okay.
And he was into nutrition at the time because he had come out with his vitamin C theories in a cold. So anyway, I wrote a book about nutrition called Mega Nutrition. And soon after that, my agent called from San Diego and said, "Have you ever heard about Dr. Virginia Livingston?" And I said, "Yes, I know all about her. Why?" And he said, "Well, she wants to write a book about her work for the man on the street. And we're looking for someone who knows about medical subjects." I said, "Great," because I had seen a speech she gave at the Orthomolecular Medical Society. She had identified a microbe that caused this cancer. And from that microbe, she made a vaccine. And she was giving people this immune system vaccine and curing 90% of all her patients who had all become declared terminal when they came to her clinic. Anyway, so I said, "Okay, I don't want to get involved with a quack. I'd like to go down and see her and work with her and visit her." I went down to her clinic and worked at her clinic, talked to her patients, talked to her staff, and finally wrote her book for her. It was called The Conquest of Cancer by Dr. Virginia Livingston Wheeler with Ed Addio. And then 35 years later, I just did a new book, a survey of what's going on now in treating cancer. And I just came out with another book called, what's the name of my new book? The Woman Who Cured Cancer is the title. It's about Dr. Virginia. And it's been pretty well received. We've had some patients. The man, the biochemist who developed the vaccine with Dr. Virginia, is still alive up in Redmond, Washington, still making the vaccine for people. He's 94 years old. I've been sending cancer patients up to him with great results. I'll tell you a brief story. There was a woman who had it's got a Mill Valley angle, woman who had the antique shop on Miller Avenue, Nellu. She got a squamous cell carcinoma in her nasal septum about a year and a half ago. She was getting these terrible growths from under her eyes and out of her nose. She was starting to look like Frankenstein. So she had a local doctor here. He sent her down to Stanford. Stanford sent her all around, sent her department to department. Meanwhile, she's getting uglier and uglier. And kind of attractive woman, 60-ish, blonde. And finally, Stanford came back to her and said, "Well, we've figured out your treatment, but we have to cut off your nose and part of your skull above your eye." And she, make a long story short, she said, "No, you're not going to cut off my nose. I'm not going to do that." So she came back to her doctor here. He gave her a copy of my book, The Woman Who Cured Cancer.
Is this doctor, what's the doctor's name here?
Wierschke, Dr. Arnold Wierschke. And so she called me. I hadn't met her at a Mill Valley coffee shop, had a cup of coffee. I told her all about the vaccine. She sent up her urine sample to the lab in Washington, got her vaccine, started on the regimen. And today she's absolutely, totally clear, looks absolutely fine. In fact, she went to a local oncologist here a few months ago just to start a follow-up procedure. And he looked at her medical records and said, "You don't have any cancer. What are you doing here?" And she said, "Well, look at this. Stanford wanted to cut my nose off. Look, I had squamous cell carcinoma." Doctor said, "You're perfectly fine today." And would you believe it? She gave that doctor a copy of the book and said, "I'm out on this vaccine." And he still hasn't read it, refuses to read it. Incredible. Anyway, so that's my writing career. I'm currently working on a mystery novel with my grandson, who's graduating from UC Santa Barbara with a degree in English, wants to be a writer.
Is he the poor are guy. You truly collaborating, or is he the lead? Or
I'm the lead. He's busy. You know, he's just, you know, making contributions as he has the time. But I'm kind of stuck. I've never written a mystery, and I don't quite know how to finish it. And then I got a couple of other irons in the fire, too. I'm doing a documentary on Rita Abrams, the lady who wrote Mill Valley, that song. Doing a documentary on her. And I finally published the reason I quit McGraw-Hill these many years ago was to write an epic historical novel about Yosemite Valley. When I quit McGraw-Hill, Tavita and I and the girls went up and lived in Yosemite for 2 months. My secretary at McGraw-Hill was going with a fireman who was building a cabin in a little private section of Yosemite Valley called Foresta. And he let us live in his cabin for 2 months. So I did all my research up there, talked to a lot of Miwok Indians. And over the course of almost 30 years, I finished the novel. It's like, remember what's his name novel about Hawaii, Michener, James Michener? Well, this is the Hawaii of Yosemite Valley.
Okay, and it hasn't been published yet?
I self-published it finally.
Okay.
I had a lot of publishers interested in publishing it, but they wanted me to put in a woman, an upwardly mobile woman. You know, like Clan of the Cave Bear, who she invented fire and everything. Well, the Miwok Indians, with the women, were sitting around grinding acorns, making mush to eat while the men were off hunting. It was a very poor tribe inland. So there were no upwardly mobile women, and I didn't want to compromise the historical accuracy of the novel. So while a couple of publishers wanted to publish it, if I put a woman in it, I kept declining. Finally published it myself now with the miracle of digital publishing. So it's out now. It's on Amazon. I don't know how it's doing at all, but it's a good book. Everybody who reads it really thinks it's a good book. So that's about it.